This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The White Sox will carry a 2-1 lead over the Angels into Game 4 when the two teams meet in Anaheim tonight. In last night's game, Chicago beat Anaheim 5-2 on the strength of John Garland's pitching and Paul Konerko's 3 runs batted in. In the National League Championship Series, Houston and St. Louis are tied at 1 game apiece. The Astros and Cardinals will play Game 3 this afternoon. Joining me now from Houston, where that game will transpire, is Brian Burwell, a columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Brian, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thank you for having me back.
In last year's National League Championship Series, St. Louis defeated Houston. It took them 7 games. Does that add a dimension of excitement to this year's series?
I think it does, because I think going into the division series, there wasn't that much drama to that because you knew that the San Diego Padres were the inferior team. You knew that the Cardinals were going to take care of business, and they did, and they took care of business rather quickly. But here there's a great deal of intrigue because the pitching that Houston has is so good, it causes a lot of people to be nervous.
The Cardinals and the Astros, even at 1 at this point, it looks as though the rematch will be just as competitive. What intrigues you most about this series, beyond the pitching?
Well, it's the pitching. It's nothing. It's all there is to it. I mean, Roy Oswalt, he was just magnificent. He had several instances where the Cardinals could have scored, and the Cardinals were unable to score in 8 opportunities where they had runners in scoring position. You know, you're sitting there going, boy, you just don't want to get to Brad Lidge, because if Brad Lidge gets there, you're in trouble. Yeah, well, guess what? The prelude to Lidge was a lot more interesting than Lidge, because Oswalt was missed the lights out.
This year marks the 20th anniversary of the infamous blown call by umpire Don Denkinger. Many Cardinals fans, of course, insist that cost their team the 85 World Series. Do they have a feeling of deja vu as they watch replay after replay of what happened in Chicago this week?
I don't know if they do. I think they are so haunted by that memory that I think if it doesn't matter if you just say Don Denkinger, they start flinching nervously. But they can't help it. They really can't.
This is the final year the Cardinals will play in Busch Stadium, their home for nearly 40 years. I wonder if this is kind of a bittersweet time for fans who love their tradition in St. Louis.
Well, as a unromantic outsider, I kind of look at it with a bit of curiosity and amusement because, first of all, it's a 39-year-old stadium. It's not exactly the Roman Coliseum. And if you recall, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, it really wasn't that nice a stadium. It was a cookie-cutter, indistinguishable stadium that, other than the arches, the arch porticos at the top, there was nothing really romantic about this place. It was just a hot box. But now there's a lot of romance, and there's a lot of tearfulness, and I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't really. I'm an outsider, I guess. I don't get it. And when you're down in the belly of the old stadium, you understand why they're tearing this place down. There's this noise that happens, and we're not really sure where it's coming from. Whether it's pipes, or there's some sort of creature lurking in the shadows, but it makes this noise that sounds like two whales mating.
You know, you'll get no sympathy from me. I've been in the tunnel that runs from the dugout to the clubhouse in Fenway Park.
Okay, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. By the way, the tunnel that runs between the clubhouse, the home team clubhouse, and the dugout at Busch Stadium, you have to always keep your head up because there's always leaks coming down from the ceiling, and if you're not paying attention, you will get some sort of very strange, murky colored water on your head.
Yes, I'd be right at home after yes. My experiences at Fenway.
But it's romantic, gosh almighty.
That's the definition of romance, my
friend. I could write some poetry about the strange aroma coming from that water all the time.
Brian Burwell is a columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Brian, thanks again.
My pleasure, always.
50 autumns ago, the Brooklyn Dodgers won that team's first and only World Series. As far as Brooklyn fans were concerned, Dem Bums not only beat their perennial rivals, the Yankees, they also righted one of history's great wrongs. Only a Game's John Kalish reports from New York.
Campanella back of the plate, Hodges at first, Robinson at second, Reese at short, Cox at third.
The Dodgers played at Ebbets Field, a secular shrine for many Brooklynites. Back in 1955, Joe Dorenson was a college student living in Brooklyn.
There was a camaraderie at Ebbets Field that I don't think you got anywhere else. There was intimacy. You were close to the field, you were close to the players, you were rooting passionately for your team, and you tried to evoke the blessings of God, even though most of us felt that God was a Yankee fan.
You could hardly blame the Dodger faithful for thinking the Almighty smiled on the Yankees. In a 12-year span from 1941 to 1953, the Yankees beat the Dodgers five times in the World Series. But 1955 was different. Writer and Brooklyn native Pete Hamill says the team brought more to the field that year than just baseball talent.
The players outdid themselves that year. It wasn't just a big home run hitting team. There was an emotion that the Dodgers brought on the field. There was a fierce quality to it. Run hard. Slide on your belly if you have to. Get in there. Steal home. Imagine Robinson steals home seven times in one year. That team in 55 was so good that a young kid never got to throw a baseball in the World Series, and his name was Koufax.
But pitching was the one department where the Dodgers were lacking, says Joe Dorenson, who's now a history professor at Long Island University.
If you go position by position, the Dodgers were superior at every position except pitching. And that, of course, is 80 to 90% of the game, pitching and defense.
With a regular season record of 9-10, Brooklyn pitcher Johnny Padres wasn't exactly a standout that season, but he played a pivotal role in the 1955 World Series. Brooklyn lost the first two games at Yankee Stadium, but Padres ignited the Dodger comeback by winning Game 3 at Ebbets Field on his 23rd birthday. He also prevailed in Game 7 and was named Most Valuable Player of the World Series. Shortstop Pee Wee Reese was also instrumental in the Dodger victory that season. Stan Isaacs covered the team for the Long Island newspaper Newsday.
Reese was the heart and soul of that team. He determined the character of the team, and that's why they always looked upon with great favor. He was a nice guy, and his class rubbed off on the other players. Reese is the one who, in effect, welcomed Robinson that day when he was being pilloried in Cincinnati in his first year in batting practice.
By the way, Isaacs is one of the handful of newspaper writers who were so passionate about the Dodgers that they got together and swiped the old 1955 World Series banner from the L.A. Dodgers. They brought it back to New York in 1959. It's currently on display at the Brooklyn Historical Society. Writer Pete Hamill says that Brooklyn passion had a lot to do with Jackie Robinson, who united the fans in the stands and provided the team with a moral advantage.
We had the Irish tribe, we had the Italian tribe, we had the Jewish tribe, and with Robinson, we had the African-American tribe. Everybody was in the same place, rooting for the same team. And that was not happening at Yankee Stadium and a lot of other places. But in terms of this perennial October conflict, we felt we had a moral edge. It might be hard to explain now to people that you could invest that much in a baseball team. Brooklyn wasn't the only place where this emotion was. There was a whole extended fandom of some kind that had to do with people who had waited a long, long time to see a man with black skin play in the major leagues. There were kids in Alabama rooting for the Brooklyn Dodgers, because if they made it, maybe they could play ball in the major leagues, too.
In the bottom of the sixth inning in Game 7, the Dodgers were winning by a score of 2-0.
Gil McDougal beats out a bunt to Padres, and the Yankees have the tying runs on base. And up comes Yogi Berra.
The Yankee catcher sliced a long drive to left field just outside the foul pole. Sitting in the stands with a bird's-eye view of it all was Dodger fan Al Lewis, who in later years came to be known as Grandpa on the hit TV series The Munsters.
Yogi Berra hit the ball to left field. and Sandy Amrose, who was a lefty with the glove on the right hand, reached out, caught it just as he hit the stand, turned around, and doubled the guy off first. A righty would never have caught it.
That play killed the Yankees' sixth-inning rally. In the eighth inning, pitcher Johnny Padres escaped a two-men-on jam. And in the ninth, after Elston Howard grounded out to Pee Wee Reese, Brooklyn's beloved Dodgers had beaten the Yankees on enemy turf. For Dem Bums, next year had finally arrived. Once again, writer Pete Hamill.
It was like saying to Sisyphus, "You're at the top of the mountain. The rocks ain't going to roll back down again." It was a mythic kind of triumph at the end, and a sense of, "God damn it, we did it." And it was always we, you know. And it was, in a way, very American. It was about getting through it and showing what you could do with effort and will and guts and heart. I remember walking around that night on the last game thinking, I'll remember this all my life.
That night at the official Dodger celebration, players went out one at a time to wave at the thousands of fans gathered outside the Bossard Hotel in downtown Brooklyn. Brooklynites were hollering on rooftops and dancing in the streets that night. God may have been a Yankee fan, but on October 4th, 1955, Dem Bums took matters into their own hands. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Lo Siento, Mexico. CONCACAF has a new king. But first, in Bridgeview, Illinois, a village of 15,000 people just 16 miles from Chicago's Loop, a soccer stadium is taking shape. Scheduled to open in 8 months, the new home of Major League Soccer's Chicago Fire will seat 20,000 people and include 48 luxury suites. According to John Guppy, the president and CEO of the Fire, who spoke with me recently in a trailer beside the construction site, the need for the new home is obvious.
We play in Soldier Field right now, fantastic stadium, but obviously we're not the primary tenant, so I don't think there's any better example of why we need our own stadium than the situation we're in right now. We're in the middle of a 57-day streak without a home game because there's just no availability at Soldier Field because of the Chicago Bears.
The Fire's new stadium will be unencumbered not only by Bears but by football's yard lines, and fans will be much closer to the pitch than in Soldier's Field. John Guppy may not be exaggerating when he calls the new building a field of dreams, but Steve Landick, the mayor of Bridgeview, who joined us in the trailer that day, made it clear that dreams had nothing to do with why he'd pushed the Fire to relocate to his village. His reason was more practical.
Capitalism. So we had 100 acres of vacant land looking to be redeveloped.
What I see today when I stand on the slab that will soon support the floors for those luxury suites is mud and potential parking for 6,000 cars. But what Mayor Landick sees is the promise of prosperity.
We have already had inquiries from two or three hotels, restaurants, other areas of entertainment. We have a movie theater that's moving in the town, 14 screens. It's a $12, $14 million project. That's already the spinoff from the stadium. So we're pretty optimistic this is going to work out for us. We have a good sales tax base now, and it's only going to improve it.
That optimism has led the mayor, on behalf of the citizens of Bridgeview, to take what for some communities of 15,000 might be considered a big league financial plunge.
We sold bonds for $120 million. We went out and got a loan, a mortgage, if we look at it just in the terms of home ownership. So we own a $120 million house, and the mortgage payment on that is $7.2 million a year. we need to generate $7.2 million from the sales at this stadium. So that'll be through concessions, parking, skyboxes, naming rights. All those factors come together to generate 7.2 to pay the debt service. And we're not going to use, the plan is not to use any corporate money or, you know, any tax money that the people have paid to pay for the stadium. It should be entirely self-funded.
Mayor Landick maintains that a $2.5 million naming rights payment and additional payments from major sponsors and advertisers known as founding partners will put Bridgeview in a position to make half the first payment on its debt before the stadium even opens. But regarding founding partners, Landick may be getting ahead of himself.
None have been announced. My understanding is that they're still talking to numerous companies.
Stephanie Gehring is a staff writer for the Daily Southton, a newspaper based in Tinley Park, Illinois.
Our soccer beat reporter had a story a while back that the bank, which actually the mayor works for, was going to have the naming rights to the stadium, but they haven't made any major announcement as far as that's concerned.
There are other economic concerns. The previously empty 100-acre plot that will eventually accommodate the stadium and its parking lots extends a little beyond Bridgeview and into Bedford Park, a neighboring community that wants to be compensated for the tax revenues it would have realized had it developed the land itself. Then there's the matter of Bridgeview's bond rating, which Standard & Poor's recently dropped from A to A-, citing the extraordinarily high debt levels of nearly $15,000 per capita created by the stadium mortgage. But that doesn't mean Mayor Landick is being unrealistic about stadium income, according to Standard & Poor's analyst Helen Samuelson.
It's a very conservative assumption, and our response was based on being conservative. You know, until the soccer stadium is operating and fully functional, the assumption is that there are no profits to support the debt service for the bonds. Any success that they have at all with the stadium should only help ease the burden on taxpayers.
While Bridgeview is counting on stadium revenues to fund the debt, the Fire, which will pay Bridgeview $300,000 annually as the primary tenant of the stadium, is entitled to 50% of the parking fees, 92% of the gross ticket revenue, 50% of the net concessions, and nearly a quarter of the gross revenue from merchandise sales. That helps to explain why Neil DeMoss, the co-author of a study of stadium construction titled Field of Schemes, is skeptical about the economics of the stadium in Bridgeview.
If the city is actually going to be getting back $7, $8 million a year on its investment, that's a great deal. The question is it reasonable to expect that much money to come in from soccer games? MLS has 15 home games a year. You're talking 200,000, 300,000 fans a year. It's going to be awfully difficult to generate millions of dollars for the city at the same time you're generating profits for the team.
The new stadium would be better prepared than most soccer venues to attract alternative events. The Fire is one of the teams owned by AEG, the Philip Anschutz-run corporation that owns theaters and arenas across the country and promotes concerts as well as sports events. The stadium in Bridgeview will include a permanent stage for concerts, and Mayor Landick anticipates that the facility will eventually host as many music events as it does pro soccer games. The concerts would be Bridgeview's safety net, though Mayor Landick doesn't think MLS is likely to stumble or fall.
Well, those are the worst scenarios, but I look at it this way. If you have Mr. Hunt and Mr. Anschutz, they're pretty successful guys. If they're gambling, putting a lot of money into this venture, I tend to think we need to take a look at it and say that's, you know, that they're not always going to pick winners, but I think this one's going to be a winner.
Mayor Landick's conviction that he has attracted a winner to Bridgeview apparently convinced the village's trustees to back the plan. They approved it at a September board meeting without discussion, though Mayor Landick has said that doesn't mean the trustees were rubber-stamping his plan. He has, according to Daily Southton staff writer Stephanie Gehring, acknowledged that his management style is top-down.
He really likes to know what's going on in his village. He has described himself to me as a control freak. His own words were that he was a self-described control freak.
The question with something like a new stadium is, how much will a control freak who's done the math and partnered with Philip Anschutz be able to control? Mayor Landick believes that the arrival of the Chicago Fire in his village will help revitalize an area that was previously empty, but Field of Schemes co-author Neil DeMoss has heard too many mayors and too many owners of too many sports franchises make similar promises. He'll have to be convinced.
It is very very difficult to get people to open a restaurant or a hotel or anything like that across the street from a place that's dark most days of the year. You can do a little bit better with arenas because at least you can put a basketball team and a hockey team and some concerts in there. But, you know, in terms of being a catalyst for other economic activity, in terms of bang for the buck, in terms of job creation, study after study after study has shown that stadiums are just absolutely the worst way to spend your money.
History, or at least history as interpreted by Neil DeMoss, does not deter Mayor Steve Landick. Where others saw the empty lot left behind by defunct businesses, Mr. Landick saw opportunity, and he maintains that with regards to this project, he's acting according to the wishes of his constituency.
We've been at it now over 2 years, and we haven't had any opposition to the project. They're well aware of what we plan on doing, and I tend to think the fact they don't say anything that gives me the sense that they approve of what we have planned.
Mayor Landick and Fire President and CEO John Guppy report that construction of the new, still unnamed stadium is on schedule. If that remains the case, the Fire will play its first game in Bridgeview next June. The U.S. men's soccer team was in Boston this week to prepare for their final match in the process of qualifying for the World Cup final in Germany next summer. Wednesday night's match in Foxborough against Panama was, to some extent, merely an exercise, since the U.S. had piled up enough points in previous games to ensure the team's spot in Germany. But Coach Bruce Arena had announced that he would use the game as an opportunity to experiment with different combinations of players and various tactical configurations. Even in games that have no bearing on qualification for the final, individual players have the opportunity to earn more serious consideration from Coach Arena and, in some cases, to achieve personal goals. Eddie Pope, who has been playing for the national team since 1996 and who has said this will be his final campaign with the squad, hoped to earn a spot on the team that will go to Germany. For Taylor Twellman, who's been a prolific scorer for the New England Revolution for several years, the goal was to finally kick one home for the national team, a distinction that was denied him during the October 8th loss to Costa Rica when he was twice ruled offsides after scores. When I had the opportunity to speak with Eddie Pope and Taylor Twellman on Tuesday afternoon, I began by asking the latter what he'd have to do to break through.
Stay on sides, pretty much.
The articles leading up to this, a lot of the writers writing about this game have said that this is Bruce Arena's opportunity to experiment. How do you feel about being involved in an experiment? Is that all right with you?
I think experiment's kind of a harsh word. I'd say more of a, you know, tryout and more of an audition for us to, you know, just show ourselves and following guys like Eddie's footsteps. So, you know, the key is we still want to win games. You know, we can evaluate players all we want, but we still want to win, and that's what we're trying to do.
The kind of feeling of winning, as important as it has been in previous years, where if you don't win, you don't get to make the trip to the World Cup?
I mean, yeah, obviously there's not the pressure of that, but I think, you know, everyone wants to win. We're all very competitive, or else we wouldn't do what we do for a living. So we hate losing. Everyone wants to win. The coaches have made it important that we do win. And you don't want to get into a sort of a losing rut or have a losing attitude. That's just not what this team is about. So every time we step on the field, you know, this team really wants to try to win.
In this circumstance where the coach is going through a decision-making process, trying to figure out who, in fact, is going to go overseas, who's going to go to Germany, do you find yourselves second-guessing? Do you find yourselves looking at each other on the field and saying, oh, geez, he didn't do quite as well as he might have. Well, God, he didn't get quite as many minutes as I thought he might have. Maybe he's not on the short list. Does that kind of thinking come into it at all?
I don't think so. I mean, there's a lot can happen, you know, in whatever, 6, 7, 8 months. You know, I know there's a couple guys on the World Cup roster that never played in a qualifier. So just got to take it day by day, game by game, and go from there. But, you know, there's not a lot of competition amongst players themselves. It's just, you know, taking care of your personal business.
What in that case is your personal business? How do you see your personal business vis-a-vis this team at this time?
Mine, I just need to be a good target forward. You know, I got to follow in Brian McBride, Brian Ching's footsteps of being a big guy up front, helping the team out defensively, and hopefully stay on side and get a goal.
Okay. And what about you? Are you seeing yourself, Eddie, as just having to do what you've been doing so successfully for 9 years now, or do you have a role as kind of helping to bring the next generation of players to their potential?
Yeah, I think it's both. You know, certainly know that I have to take a leadership role. And, you know, that's important for me to do. It's important for the team. And then, you know, for me, I just do what I've always done before. You know, what comes natural to me, try to follow my instincts and play that way. I think to change at this stage of the game would be difficult and probably not that smart. So,
okay, one last thing. Taylor, you mentioned there's a lot of time between these games and next summer, and of course there is. Is there a sense of momentum that's developed if you win the last qualifier or two? Do you carry momentum to Germany, or is it so much time between the two that doesn't really come into it?
I think you want to, you know, obviously this year was a very good year for U.S. soccer and how we took care of qualifying pretty early, and I think we would rather end it on a good note than ending it, you know, a little sour. So we all know what the task is, and we're at home, and we need 3 points.
Kind of fun to have so many teammates who are MLS players rather than sort of half and half or so many guys coming back from Europe or someplace else to play?
Yeah, I think it's great, you know, that so many MLS players are part of the World Cup team. I think last time in the World Cup we had a lot of MLS guys on the field, and they all did very well. And I think it's important. It says a lot about our league, and it helps, I guess, to get some more respect for our league, and, you know, that a lot of guys are coming from the MLS and stepping on the field and doing well in World Cup qualifiers.
And Eddie keeps kicking me in practice, so it's cool.
As it turned out, Wednesday night's game was anything but meaningless for Taylor Twellman. In the 57th minute, he took advantage of a sloppy clearing pass and slid a shot behind Panama's fallen keeper for Twellman's first international goal. More significantly, on the same night, Mexico dropped a 2-1 game to Trinidad and Tobago, and the 2-0 win over Panama enabled the U.S. team to finish at the top of the CONCACAF group for the first time in the team's history. You're listening to Only a Game. Jane Heil, who lives in the Philadelphia area, emailed this week to say she thinks of Only a Game as the John McPhee of sports. That's a compliment that's gratifying to the show. I hope the Pulitzer Prize-winning Mr. McPhee feels the same way. Ms. Heil ends her email with this question. Can you tell me what the thin bands are that many football players wear above their elbows? What purpose do they serve? While some on the Only a Game crack research team were sure those bands did have some sort of therapeutic or performance-enhancing purpose, Noel Vigue, head coach of strength and conditioning at Boston University's Athletic Enhancement Center, set us straight with the following explanation.
The white armbands just above the elbows are purely ornamental. They are for show. Originally, when you'd see that, you'd think they have to have some sort of purpose there because they have the turf tape that they'll put on their forearms and elbow to prevent turf burn, elbow pads, typical ones that you see on most athletes. But those sweatbands do nothing, nothing. There's no purpose to those whatsoever. And if they said that there was a purpose, they would be completely full of it.
During last week's conversation with Charlie Pierce, the matter of peculiar injuries suffered by professional athletes came up. Charlie mentioned the Washington Redskins quarterback who knocked himself unconscious headbutting a stadium girder and identified the player as Mark Rippon. A number of listeners emailed to correctly identify the Washington player who knocked himself out as Gus Frerotte. The cruelest of the listeners responding to the misidentification suggested that as punishment, Charlie should be required to hit his head 3 times against a metal I-beam attached to the Green Monster in Fenway Park in order to symbolize the 3-game demise of the Boston Red Sox. Tom Peerless, who listens to the show on WMRA in Harrisonburg, Virginia, suggested that Charlie should apologize to Mark Rippon, quote, whom most Washington fans remember for his quiet competence and relatively mistake-free play in leading the team to a 14-2 record and being named MVP in Super Bowl XXVI. You can email your corrections, suggestions, or good wishes to onlyagame at wbur.bu.edu, or you can reach us through the aforementioned website, onlyagame.org. Our address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, after a year among the Ravens, John Feinstein is not necessarily inclined to croak nevermore. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
I want to give you a chance to respond to some criticism here. On Thursday, Max Trabb, who hears the show on WAMC in Albany, New York, emailed to ask you to stop yelling because it wakes up his wife and it makes her cranky. So can you tone things down a bit this week?
Hey, Max!
In
Make your wife some toast!
In the baseball postseason, we have apparently reached a point where we can discuss what the league championship series are supposed to be about, namely good pitching. You agree?
I agree, and we've had a couple of very strong efforts, particularly Roy Oswalt for the Astros in Game 2 of the National League Championship Series. And the American League Series, I got what I wished for last week, which was if we're going to lose the Red Sox, lose the Yankees too,
mm-hmm.
and you've got two very well-matched teams playing very well together.
You have not been shy in the past about criticizing really bad officiating in all sports, Charlie. Does the case of the mysterious strike three call during Wednesday's Game 2 of the Angels-White Sox series qualify as such?
I think it does. I also think we ought to eliminate any talk right now at the outset that this will cost anybody the series either way. If an umpire's call at the end of Game 2 cost you the series, you were going to lose it anyway. I do agree with Doug Eddings, the umpire who made the call, saying that the one biggest thing he did wrong was not to make a call emphatically, thereby allowing players to go out there and finagle, as baseball players will do.
Cubs shortstop Nomar Garciaparra appears to be making excellent use of his offseason, don't you think?
Yes, he saved two women who had fallen into the harbor. He heard a scream and a splash, and apparently Nomar ran out the door to help the woman, and her friend fell in and hit her head in the pier, and Nomar pulled them both out, and there is no truth to the rumor that he picked them up and threw them over the first baseman's head on the way to shore.
More evidence that things are changing at the track, Mr. NASCAR. The guy who runs the whole show, his name is Brian France, and he has come out against the stars and bars. What is he thinking?
He's thinking that NASCAR is now a national sport and not strictly a southern sport. Of course, Bill France, who founded NASCAR, was a very big contributor and supporter of Governor George Wallace way back in the day. That happens to be how NASCAR got the Talladega Superspeedway. And Brian France feels free now to talk to 60 Minutes and saying, it's not a flag I look at with anything favorable. He says, I can tell you the flag we get behind, it's the American flag. If the stars and bars is fading in NASCAR, hopefully it's fading everywhere.
I agree. The NHL season is young, but there seems to be little doubt that the highly touted Sidney Crosby is, in fact, the league's new poster boy, at least according to one measure.
He's stealing his jerseys. This is the second
Everywhere
time.
Everywhere he goes.
In January, he lost a Canadian national team jersey that he worn when they had beaten Russia for a gold medal. Now the White Penguins jersey that he wore before his first NHL game has disappeared from an airline baggage handler. Now, I've talked to people in the disreputable memorabilia industry, and apparently airline baggage handlers, there's a strong and very lucrative underground among airline baggage handlers who handle the baggage for various teams.
The 1-3 Minnesota Vikings,
in an
apparent effort to boost team morale and improve upon their lousy early season record, took matters into their own hands last week, but then they lost last Sunday anyway. Why?
Exhaustion, I would
so
have
too.
To say. This is an ongoing, unfolding family values, cultural war, disaster for a team that wasn't going many places anywhere, but apparently has decided in one case to go someplace by boat, and it was a place they shouldn't go. There have been allegations of prostitution, drugs, and live sex acts. I, for one, am shocked. Shocked to learn that all this goes on. It's not going away anytime soon. It's a perfect paradigm for people who want to discuss professional athletes in the worst possible way.
Last Saturday, the team representing Northwestern College, a small Christian college in Roseville, Minnesota, played a doubleheader. Do you think this will encourage NFL players to believe they can, I don't know, go more often than once a week?
Not only did they play a doubleheader, they swept it.
Absolutely. They won them both.
The great thing was when the college's athletic director called the NCAA and asked if there was a rule for prohibiting a football team from playing twice in a day. The reply was, pardon me?
Charlie, last week I had the opportunity to speak with Olympic skier and former University of Colorado football player Jeremy Bloom, whom the NCAA eventually prevented from playing college football because he was earning endorsement money as a skier. There's news this week that Mr. Bloom is not quite ready to give up football.
No, he's gonna come back, and a week after the Winter Olympics are over is the NFL Scouting Combine. Apparently, he's going to fly back and run some laps and lift some weights and parade around in his shorts for the various overseers of the various NFL plantations, and good for him.
Ron Artest fans will be delighted to learn that nothing will change this season for the excitable young man. This is according to Mr. Artest's most recent self-assessment, right?
He's going to play out of control, which I think he's meaning in a good way, but in the context of his career is probably a bad way. He had 8 points, 3 rebounds, and 3 fouls in 12 minutes in a game against the Nets the other night. It's the first time he's played in any kind of NBA game since the fight last November 19th. He says he doesn't think anybody's going to throw anything at him, and he doesn't see himself reacting the way he did. I hope he's right on both counts.
Mike Krzyzewski will coach the U.S. basketball team at the 2006 World Championships and also at the 2008 Olympics, according to an announcement this week, Charlie. But if the team really tanks at the World Championships, do you think they let Coach K run the show at the Olympics anyway?
Well, I'm not exactly sure, since Jerry Colangelo is running USA Basketball's senior program, and he's notoriously impatient with failure. Krzyzewski was the assistant on the 1992, the original and most famous Dream Team. I don't think it's going to be a college pro thing at all. Colangelo seems open to the idea of having college players play. I have a feeling we're probably going to have a lot of, we'll show these guys how to behave in international competition stuff. He's still got to win, though, and if he goes too heavily on the college players, I hope the people who've been demanding their return are interested in another sixth place finish, because that's what they're going to get.
And finally, Charlie, a soccer fan in Sweden who won 122.8 million crowns in the lottery there wants to use the money to buy his favorite player from the Italian club Juventus so that he'll come and play on this guy's favorite club team in Sweden. You like his odds?
I don't like his odds, because apparently the new millionaire is an avid fan of a team that is apparently sort of the Chicago Cubs of
Swedish
second
soccer.
Of Swedish soccer. But probably the reason is, it's based on an island in the middle of the Baltic Sea. Now, unless they've got some real estate developing going on there, I don't like the guy's chances.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and has never, as far as I know, been syndicated in Gotland, the Swedish island in the Baltic Sea. He does join me each week at this time on Only Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill. And thanks, Max!
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. Next Man Up, John Feinstein's new book, discusses in great and sometimes gory detail the 2004-2005 Baltimore Ravens season. Coming off a division championship, the Ravens figured to be a contender during the year Feinstein spent with the team. For a variety of reasons, they did not win as often as everyone associated with the team thought they might. And last winter, they watched the playoffs on TV, a circumstance that one might assume disappointed the writer who was along for the ride. We'll see. John Feinstein joins me now from his home in Maryland. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, good to talk to you again. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Suspense was obviously not the point in this book, but when you arranged to spend a season with the Ravens, I assume that you hoped they'd at least be a playoff team.
You assume correctly. And I thought they would be a playoff team based on, as you mentioned, the fact that they had been in the playoffs in 2003. They were the third youngest team in the NFL in 2003. And as they got older, you would hope that they would get better. But I think in a way, Bill, the book might have turned out better as a story because of the ups and downs. It wasn't a bump-free ride. It was, in fact, a very bumpy ride. And in some ways, I think that makes for better storytelling. But certainly, I would have loved to have had at least one playoff game as part of that story.
The Ravens have incurred more than their share of notoriety. One of the team leaders, Ray Lewis, pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice following a murder investigation. Jamal Lewis went to jail for his involvement in a drug deal. Two players nicknamed Zeus and Sizzle might charitably be characterized as out of control on the field. Was that part of the attraction?
There was a lot of that, that they were a team that had players that were known nationally. I didn't obviously want this to be a book that would interest people only in Baltimore. I wanted to be with one team throughout the season. The Ravens were willing to give me access. The owner, Steve Bisciotti, knows me and trusted me. I developed a good relationship with Brian Billick and Ozzie Newsome, the coach and general manager, and access is the key to what I was trying to do here, because the NFL is such a secret society most of the time. But the fact that people knew Ray Lewis and knew Jamal Lewis, as you said, and then I got the bonus of Deion Sanders, certainly added to the attraction to me as a reporter, because although, as you know, Bill, I'm always looking for those stories of guys people haven't heard of, I know the public wants to know about the famous people too.
At several points in Next Man Up, John, you seem to be defending some of the Ravens players, mm-hmm. maintaining that what they did really wasn't so bad. Did you come to feel that trouble with the law sort of went along with being a wealthy young pro athlete?
No, I wouldn't go that far. Steve Bisciotti did make the comment that I think is fair, that when you have 53 rich young guys, they're going to find some trouble, especially when many of them are immature, many of them are spoiled, many of them are uneducated. Most guys in the NFL have gone to college but haven't graduated from college. But I think that what I was trying to do was to explode some of the myths. For example, people think Ray Lewis plea bargained in the Atlanta murder trial. He didn't. The prosecutor dropped the charges during the trial because he didn't believe he could get a conviction. I wanted to let Jamal Lewis explain what he did when he was 20 years old, and he made, by his own admission, a stupid mistake. I didn't feel, particularly in the case of Jamal Lewis, that what happened made these guys bad guys. Mm-hmm. It made them people who made mistakes, and the key in terms of going forward for them, as is always the key, is their willingness to admit their mistakes.
One of the more intriguing conflicts to surface in the Baltimore clubhouse involved battling evangelical groups. Tell me how that came about.
Well, as you know, Bill, religion is a very big deal in sports today, particularly in football. And I think some of that is the violence of the game, that those who play it know they risk serious injury every time they go out to play, and they're looking for some greater power to protect them. And as a result, you see a lot of religious players in football. On the Ravens a couple of years ago, there was a conflict because the team chaplain came from one branch of Christian evangelicals when he was in college, and two of the players, Peter Boulware and Matt Stover, hooked up with another branch of Christian evangelicals, and there was this battle for religious control of the team until Brian Billick had to step in and say, this guy, the chaplain, Rod Hairston, is our chaplain. He will be in charge of what we do in terms of religion. And he told Peter Boulware and Matt Stover that their people were not welcome at the facility or in the locker room.
Did it ever strike you as ironic that some of the same players who never missed prayer meetings customarily referred to their opponents in terms that you and I can't repeat?
You know, I've seen that in sports for so long, Bill, that I guess it just doesn't have shock value for me anymore. I go back to that great scene in the movie North Dallas 40, which is very real, where the team prays before the game and they're all on their knees and asking God for help and asking God for this and that. And as soon as the minister who's delivering the prayer finishes, one of the players jumps up and says, "Let's go out and kill those blanks." Another word we can't use on the radio.
Right.
And you know, that's the way sports is. There seems to be this sense that as long as you're acting in God's name in some way, it's okay to do almost anything you want.
Brian Billick, the Ravens head coach, is a major presence in your book. He has been characterized as arrogant and self-righteous for telling mm-hmm. writers how to do their jobs and screaming at his assistant coaches on the sideline. Did you and Coach Billick get along reasonably well?
Very well, unless we talk politics. Brian is somewhat to the right of me, as are most people in sports. But even then, I mean, we kept it on a civil level most of the time. And I appreciated the fact that Brian at least knew who was running for president, which isn't always the case when you deal with people in professional sports. But yes, we did get along. Brian's very smart. He understands what reporters want. He worked in PR when he was first in the NFL for Bill Walsh in San Francisco. He particularly seemed to have an understanding of what I was trying to do. And I appreciated the fact that never once did he back off from my access. And as you know from reading the book, there were some very awkward moments that I witnessed, whether it was in the locker room or, again, when they were discussing players among the coaches, very frankly. And never once did he say, can you leave the room or can you not write that or can we discuss how you're going to write that? And as a reporter, you always have to be grateful to somebody who trusts you that much.
John, you have spent a lot of time among pro tennis players, pro golfers, Major League Baseball players, college basketball players, and their coaches. I could go on, but how did your year in the NFL compare to your previous adventures?
Well, it was a lot different than hanging out with midshipmen and cadets from Army and Navy, I can tell you that much, Bill. But I found it fascinating because, as I write in the introduction, I grew up a fan of the NFL and the AFL. I'll date myself. Joe Namath was my first hero. And then as a reporter, whenever I covered the NFL, it was so frustrating because you have so little access to the players during the week. And you're not allowed into practice most of the time. And everybody plays it so close to the vest in terms of what they say. So to get inside, to get into that secret society, to see what really does go on, to hear what people say to one another, at those very tense moments, was for me a fascinating experience. And I'll tell you one thing, whatever you think of Ray Lewis, Bill, to stand, I don't know, 10 yards away from him when he's doing that pregame dance when he's introduced is one of the most mesmerizing things I've ever seen in my life.
John Feinstein is the author of Next Man Up, A Year Behind the Lines, in today's NFL, published by Little Brown. He spoke to me from his home in Maryland. John, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Bill. Always a pleasure.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Shout out this week to Kelvin Brooks. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about John Feinstein's Next Man Up, browse Only a Game's show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Field of Schemes co-author Neil DeMoss.
People are constantly asking me, you know, what's an example of a good stadium deal? I'd love to have one, you know?
Hey, here's an idea. The team pays for its own stadium. Too radical. It'll never happen. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.